You'll find us on radio stations throughout the nation and, of course, on irishradio.com worldwide. I want to welcome a very good friend of ours, Neil O'Dowd. And Neil, people sometimes ask me, very few, mind you, but people ask me, like, how did I meet you, or how did we meet? And I remember this scruffy fellow who blew in from San Francisco, a newspaper man, a reporter, a columnist, and he came in. Yeah. Haircut? No, he didn't have it. He didn't very... The beard could have used a little something too, but you don't have to worry about that anymore. Hair?
I don't have any hair.
Okay. Well, I hope you kept some photographs of the early days, but...
That was 36 years ago, Adrian.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I remember being told the first thing is stay away from Adrian Flannery.
Well, you didn't, so you deserve everything you got. I to say that today, you know, there are reference to historic events, particularly in Irish history, and. We could start some 800 years ago, but then we don't have time for that. But today, or yesterday rather, is probably, Neil, the most significant day with the most powerful man in the world, never shy of professing his Irishness. U.S. President Joe Biden. Tongue in cheek, he put Boris Johnson, Ireland's Prime Minister, in his box, so to speak. Tell us.
Yeah, you know, Adrian, the most interesting thing about it is we knew Joe Biden was Irish. We knew he constantly proclaimed himself Irish, that he reads out speeches and ends them with quotes from Seamus Heaney and William Butler Yeats and all that. And that's not totally unusual in a politician, but the big question was, when the hard policy issues came up, would he really stand up for the Irish? And that question was answered in tremendous fashion this week, if you're Irish or an Irish-American, because Joe Biden did something that no American president has ever done. He went after the British on the basis of an Irish issue and said to them, you have to fix this. This is very important as President of the United States. I believe that the Good Friday Agreement is the single biggest thing between us and you having a good relationship. Now, to hear that coming from an American president was just incredibly, almost intoxicating, and a sense of incredible achievement in terms of all the people over the years who had tried to make this happen. And obviously we know Bill Clinton did it in the 90s, but yeah, in a very different fashion. He never engaged the British in such a direct manner as to say, look, I know we have the Transatlantic Alliance, I know we have Brexit, I know we have all this stuff, but the first thing in my agenda is don't mess with the Good Friday Agreement, because if you do, your chance of a trade deal with America is probably going to be gone. And also, the fact is that I'm going to be very, very strong on the fact that sorting out the Good Friday Agreement and making it permanent is a major policy issue. And let me just put that in context, Adrian, because it was something I learned when Clinton was president. If the president takes an interest in something, like if it's like Germany or Australia or somewhere like that, if the president takes an interest in Ireland, everybody in the White House takes an interest in Ireland. So you suddenly get this whole different mood permeating in terms of like access for Irish people, access for the Irish to the White House. And I think that's a very important development as a result of what Joe Biden has basically said. He said, look, I think like I'm Irish. I very much strongly associate with my Irish heritage. And not only that, but I'm also going to include it as part of my policy making. So I think it was an amazing week for the Irish and Irish Americans, and one that we can take a lot of satisfaction, Adrian, and you and everyone over the years. We had a lot of doors that were shut to us, and to finally get the one open that led us to a president like this is very gratifying.
Yeah. Neil, I want to, maybe this is too broad a brush, but prior to and from the time I came to the United States and the generations before us, American support for Ireland and for the conflict in Northern Ireland had to do with rah-rah, let's get the money, let's blow the Brits out of there, you know, they don't belong there in the first place. It was a great, there was tremendous enthusiasm, but in hindsight, that had run its course. And it is said not just because I say it, but, you know, the Mitchell appointment came about when Irish America became involved. And let's go back to 1992. You, as a coordinator, you and people like philanthropist Chuck Feeney, Congressman Bruce Morrison, Joe Jameson, Irish American labor leader, and then, of course, Mutual of America chairman Bill Flynn and Tom Moran, you know, had first engaged in what we thought would be a sacrilege, and that is to engage with loyalism and unionism, and, you know, and give them the international stage and, you know, the voice for their concerns. I was new, and many would say, what the hell is he doing here? What are they doing? What is this group? We know that that's never worked before.
Yeah, I mean, it was exactly as you described, that the old rah-rah had never really got us where we needed to be, because people drew a line in the sand when it came to violence. And unfortunately, no matter how you approach the issue in America, there was this very strong lobby for the IRA, which was very understandable in the context of the times, but meant that there was no country or government that could deal with you, because they wouldn't cross that line and be seen to support groups that supported violence. And that preoccupied all of us for many, many years in the 1970s and 1980s. And it was actually the inspiration, Adrian, of the Morrison and Donnelly's visa programs, which you were very heavily connected with, where we saw, when we went a different way about things, when we actually lobbied politicians, when we went to their offices, when we held demonstrations, when you pushed it like crazy on your show and I pushed it in my newspaper, that basically on-the-ground politics could work very well for us. And what we found, frankly, was, and this was commented on in a very, very smart way in the New York Times during the week, Ireland is a bilateral issue. Ireland is an issue that Republicans and Democrats, who agree on absolutely nothing, as you know, they do not disagree on Ireland. They both believe that American help is very important. And you always had a Pete King or a Jim Walsh, yeah, or someone like that who would come in on the side of the Irish government. So it was an issue that was shared on both sides. And so what we tried to do was create some energy out of that connection and say, well, if Irish America in a different way gets involved and gets all these other people like Bill Flynn, Tom Moran, Chuck Feeney, yeah, great people behind us, surely we could make much more progress than we have so far. And the idea was to go over once Clinton was elected and try and bring about a transformation in Ireland by saying, look, this is a different America you're dealing with now. You're dealing with people of the stature of the President of the United States. You're dealing with a real opportunity that has never come your way before to actually change the narrative, change the whole attitude that you're untouchable and we cannot talk to you. And in fairness, Sinn Féin and the Loyalists and the Ulster Unionists responded very strongly to the American overture, and as you said, led inevitably to George Mitchell, without whom there would not have been a Good Friday Agreement. So it was a gamble in one way, but in another way, when I see this week happening, I feel that Irish America has been enormously vindicated, because we said all along, you said it in your show, I said it in your show, I said it in my editorials, if you bring in America, the whole situation will change. And that is exactly and precisely what happened. And for people like, I wish they were alive today, Frank Dorcan and Paul O'Dwyer and people like that, who spend their lives trying to make Ireland an issue in the United States. I'm sure there were, I don't know about Paul being in heaven, but Frank and everyone else who spend their life working for this very day that Ireland would be a key issue between the British government and the American government. It was a very happy day indeed.
We were both in Belfast on the day of the signing of the Good Friday Agreement, and brought back the message to those who are listening to us or reading about us in the first place, to say this is the dawning of a new age. Some of that was misinterpreted as saying, great, you know, let's just clap our hands and get on with the rest of our lives, because somehow the Northern Ireland issue has been resolved for once and for all. And a lot of people who had a very keen interest in Northern Ireland and the situation there, they went on to other things. Can you fill in that gap from, the signing of the Belfast Good Friday Agreement, and what happened to American influence, interest, and can we blame people for saying, you know, that's what we've done our bit, and now it's up to them, let them figure it out after this?
No, I don't think we can blame people, Adrian. I think there was a genuine sense that once there was a ceasefire, once there was a Good Friday Agreement, once there was a government up and running, we all remember what to me was the climactic moment when Ian Paisley and Martin McGuinness, two people who had been threatening each other for 30 years and who were absolute opposites in every way, walked down the steps of Stormont together and announced the formation of a government. At that moment, I thought it was over, because that was putting together... If you had suggested even 2 years before that McGuinness and Paisley would form a government, people would have suggested you go see a psychiatrist. So, I mean, I think that was a moment that struck me at the time. This can never go back now. And I don't think it can ever go back. But what you have is what somebody described as a cold peace. There's no warmth. There's no working together. There's a lot of disillusionment on the unionist side. There's a failure to sit down and talk to the nationalists seriously. I mean, you take Brexit, for instance. People don't know, but 56% of people in Northern Ireland voted against Brexit. But you listen to the DUP and you think that the whole country voted for it. And they're not representing anyone but a small party that didn't vote for Brexit. But nonetheless, when the British government told them they'd have to accept the border and the sea, they accepted it first. They actually approved of it and said, if it's okay, it's okay if the British government say that this is the way it is. Now, once again, they're backtracking and saying, we didn't agree to anything. But the fact is that the deal was done in December. The deal was implemented. It took years to put it together. And you can't come back 6 months later and say, well, we weren't really serious about the deal. That was just a joke. This is international diplomacy. This is an international agreement. And this is the point that Biden made. America has a dog in this fight. America has committed to the Good Friday Agreement. It committed to the Northern Protocol that was agreed between the European Union, the British government, and the Irish government. And frankly, there's no going back now. And I think that's a very important message from the Biden visit, that, you know, you can't just go around bullying people saying, well, we didn't really mean that. when we signed it, we just made it up. That's not what international diplomacy is about. And I think what did a visit by Biden prove more than anything is just how important the American influence in this is, because somebody needs to put a brake on Johnson. Somebody needs to say to him, you can't change an internationally legislated agreement that the United States, the European Union, the British government, and the Irish government all signed off on, legally binding.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, what we've seen since December is these crazy attempts to appease the unions and talk about changing the whole dynamic of the protocol. But Adrian, I think if there's one thing came out of this week, is Joe Biden slammed the door on any change on the protocol, because if Johnson now goes ahead and tries to change it, I think he realizes he'll lose a lot of the friendship that he's trying to create with Biden.
Yeah. And the friendship you refer to is, this is not just going to be a personality clash or closer to New York here, the relationship between the mayor and the governor of New York, who, you know, who seem like they spend most of their time, you know, nitpicking and taking pot shots at one another.
Right.
Johnson, Prime Minister, has got to know that there is no transition time in this. It's not, well, let's come around to some kind of an agreement. You know, Joe Biden says, look, that's it. Okay, end of story. And he has enormous power in, you know, with the, you know, forgetting the, you know, special arrangement and the great alliance with the UK. He is saying, this has to do with your welfare. You know, you want a trade deal with us? Okay, fine. Special, the traditional, you know, special relationship with the United States and the UK, that's, you want to talk about something that's going to look like a joke? That's where the joke is. So smarten up now. No transition period, nada.
No, I mean, you know, Biden made very clear that this is an international agreement. Biden made very clear that America, the European Union, and the government of Ireland was 100% committed to it. And Biden also made clear that you cannot retroactively change a treaty that was arrived at by the negotiators on all sides and fairly and squarely negotiated and agreed upon and signed. So, I mean, I think there was a wake-up call for Boris Johnson in all that. And frankly, you know, the unionists in Northern Ireland have to face reality themselves. Look, the Irish government, I was reading an article the other day, this could be dealt with through negotiation if properly put in context. What Micheál Martin said was very interesting. He said 80% of the imports have to do with beef, 80%. And if that was processed in a different way, like apparently there's an arrangement between Switzerland and the European Union, yeah, where you don't have to go through customs to declare the beef. It's declared at the point of entry. In other words, it would be checked out in Switzerland before it went into, there would be no border issue when it goes into the European Union. And those options are there. There are ways you can work around this. And, you know, if somebody said to you, well, it's only going to affect 20% of the goods, we've given you a big concession, I'm sure you'd find that most people would say, well, that's fair enough. And that's the kind of answer that will solve this in the end. Some kind of self-facing, safe-facing maneuver where Johnson can say, well, you know, we got a deal, and Biden will say, if the Irish government's happy, I'm happy. And I think that's the only way this can work, because right now Johnson is not going to get what he wants, and the unionists are getting uglier and uglier about it, unfortunately.
Yeah. I want to address a, and we may have to double back to the situation in Northern Ireland then, before the Belfast Agreement, where it was assumed that the Catholic minority were the ones who were getting screwed over through work and opportunities everywhere you looked. Very little attention was paid to the fact that the unionist population, the working class, they were nearly as bad, if not worse off, than the Catholic community, and they had no voice. They were not getting any attention at all.
That's precisely what we discovered when we went over there in the 90s, was that if you walked up to Falls Road and walked back down to Shankill Road, which are right beside each other, you wouldn't know which was the worse off, because the unionist side, the loyalist side of the Shankill Road, was terribly run down, disheveled. There was a very, very low graduation of high school students. Almost nobody in those communities went to college. So they weren't getting any big deal at all, Adrian. They were just, it's a bit like some of these Trump supporters who are sending their social welfare checks to Trump. I mean, it makes no sense that they are defending what is actually hurting them, which is actually getting in their way, which is a deal on Brexit would ultimately result in much more employment, much more money, much more investment in Northern Ireland. But they've been led by these very, very poor leaders who convince them that it's all about the same thing over and over, which is the safety of the union with Great Britain and Ireland. But that's not the story, because if you talk about the Catholics, the demographic is moving very rapidly in favour of Catholics in Northern Ireland. So at some point, you have to solve Brexit, and then you have to talk about the border poll. Those are the two huge issues confronting Northern Ireland. And the good news, Adrian, is that we have a man in the White House who is totally and utterly on the side of the Irish and is prepared to back us in everything that we do, which I think is just massively significant. If you consider, say, Donald Trump, who, in fairness, did appoint a peace envoy towards the end of his administration, but he really had no dog in the Irish fight, whereas Biden definitely does, and that could make all the difference.
Neil, as we know, with historic events like the meeting and, with Boris Johnson, which resulted in a joint statement. That's news this week. Will it be news 2 months from now? Or will everybody figure, that's what happens with the summit and everything else, and that was very nice. But where's the teeth? Where are the teeth in this? And are we going to look down the road and say, and then there was the meeting with Biden and Johnson and a statement, and was it worth the paper it's written on?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think what would have come as a big surprise to the British, and even came as a surprise to a lot of Irish, was just how strong and determined Biden was on this issue. I mean, he actually had his charge d'affaires in the British Embassy in London, the highest ranking official there, go to the British Foreign Office and read to them a note that was highly critical of their handling of the Brexit situation, which is very rarely done in diplomatic circles. So I don't think this one is going away. And the reason it's not going away is that, as I said at the very beginning, Ireland is now a big issue. If you look at the people who were beside Biden in those negotiations with the British, there was Jake Sullivan, who has been handling the Irish issue, first of all for Bill Clinton, then Obama, then Hillary, and now he's handling the issue for Biden on a day-to-day basis. And a woman called Amanda Sloat, who actually is a graduate of Queen's University Belfast. So everybody surrounding Biden knows that this is very important, and they know that their boss wants this done. So I would tend to believe that we will look back on this as the breaking point, as the moment that it became obvious that the British could not change in any way what was agreed in the document that created the Northern Protocol, and that another way has to be found around it, which would be agreed to not just by the British, but by the Irish and the Americans and the European Union as well.
What about if we can, Neil, I want to pick your brain on the time being now, rather than let everybody chew on this for a while, for an envoy to Northern Ireland. That worked before, and, Senator George Mitchell, as an envoy of Clinton, that was historic, and that was terrific. Now we need somebody, but don't we need somebody to start this Monday morning and not let this, not let everything die down, not over heading into the long days of summer?
The marching season. No, I agree with you fully that one of the big objectives of Irish America has to be to get that special envoy. And I think, in fairness, they were probably waiting for this visit to be over and for the sky to be clear in terms of what the next moves were likely to be. So I think you will see the appointment, I'll make a prediction, you will see the appointment of a U.S. envoy sometime in the next 30 to 45 days. Mm-hmm. And that will be a very significant addition to the issues. And, we can't forget that what Mitchell did was be even-handed, be the outsider that came in
right.
with no axe to grind. People thought he'd be pro-nationalist. He wasn't. What you need is a figure who can sit down with the loyalists, sit down with the British, sit down with the Irish, sit down with the European Union, and agree a format that would work for everybody, and then use his own offices or her own offices to work towards that agreement. And I think, from that point of view, America has to stay involved, and I think the way they stay involved on a day-to-day basis is to appoint that envoy as soon as possible.
Mm. What role do you see for Irish America, and how do we become part of, of help to the commitment which has been now made and agreed to with the Prime Minister and U.S. President?
I think we have to reach out to the Unionists, Adrian. I know it's something that is counterintuitive, but it worked back in the 90s because the Unionists felt as isolated as they possibly could. They felt the British government was betraying them. They felt the Irish government was working against them. They felt that the rise of Sinn Féin was threatening them. And if you remember Bill Flynn and Tom Moran doing those magnificent meetings in New York with the loyalist leaders, with David Trimble, with Ian Paisley, with the Ulster Unionists, that was a very important part of the whole thing, saying to them, you're welcome. We want to hear your point of view. We want to hear your side of it. And then they found themselves going to the White House and meeting with the President. And, for guys from the Shankill Road who had never been outside Belfast, probably, it was an enormous encouragement to them to see that people cared. It wasn't all just about the Irish winning a major victory. It was about everybody finding a way through a crisis and understanding that they were part of the solution as well as part of the problem.
We also, of course, have experienced, and again on both sides of the Atlantic, the changing of the guard. And now we have somebody who we don't have to guess, about his mission and his commitment to getting this resolved. When you, organized initially the meetings with the loyalists, with the unionists, and brought them into the fold, can you expect, or can we expect, that same kind of mutual respect which resulted from that is there now, or is what about this new generation, the big bigger fish to fry? Brexit brought a separation of the UK, and the European Union. How do we not make this a small spoke in the big wheel?
Well, I think you're right in the sense that each and every group, I mean, when we went in the early 90s, we started meeting people that we were told not to meet. Mm-hmm. And those people included David Irvine, Gary McMichael, Billy Hutchinson, leading loyalist figures that we were told were basically violent men who would never come to a negotiating table. Now, we've been told the same thing about this group of loyalists, and I don't know the answer if there is a new David Irvine, if there is a new Billy Hutchinson, who's still around, by the way. But, I mean, I think we have to look for leadership where we can find it. And you can't rule out that there is a deep frustration on the loyalist side, that they feel under pressure, that they feel the U.S. Is not well disposed to them. What we want to do is the very same thing we did and say, tell us what is on your mind, tell us how you think this can be solved, and we will open up doors and access and hopefully economic opportunities as well. And I would see that as a big part of the job of the envoy, to create new links into the unionist and loyalist community for the United States and to make it easier for them to find an agreement with the other side of they could all be comfortable with. It's never going to be easy, Adrian, but if you have marching and bombs and, you're right about the height of summer with the bonfires and all that. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of room for trouble, big trouble, violence, the usual stuff, and we need to be very careful that that doesn't tip out of control.
Yeah. Could it also lead to, say, the American attitude towards Northern Ireland, that what Senator George Mitchell was able to bring in terms of being impartial, and that in itself is a reward and it has legs. How are we to expect at this point that the unionist, the loyalist community are already getting battered from every which side, are going to say, that's fine, but nobody's inviting us into this, and we're the ones who are getting through.
We're at the stage where the American involvement is going to be the critical next factor. What we saw with Biden was the opening salvo in that battle, that he basically made it clear that it's a huge issue on the agenda of the United States government. I think the next thing is for the United States government to find the next George Mitchell, to find somebody who they can identify that can go and talk to all sides in Northern Ireland. And I remember our big argument back in the 90s was when we were told, don't talk to Gerry Adams, don't talk to Martin McGuinness, don't talk to Billy Hutchinson, was, Americans, we talk to everybody.
Yeah, and that never
takes
time.
We have the First Amendment, and we talk, and it's much better to talk than to threaten violence. And I think the same thing holds. People are telling me now, the loyalists are rough people, they're drug dealers, they're this, they're that. I'm sure there is that, but I'm sure there's also people there who want to do good, who want to stop this craziness on the loyalist side of always becoming violent when there's change in the air. And I think these are the people we have to reach out to, find out about, discover, and do like we did with the group back in the 90s and make them part of the solution, not part of the problem.
At the beginning of our chat here said, what a lot of people will feel is, good job there, Joe Biden. You put that little bastard into his box. That is probably a takeaway that we're going to have to get rid of as well, in the sense that, you know, that the resolution comes because of a threat. The threat is real. So we need, again, to go back to square one and say one side cannot resolve a two-sided issue. End of story.
Yeah.
Are there going to be those who now say, I thought you guys were told by the president, get your act together? Or you know, you're the ones who are going to suffer. How is that going to sit, say, with a... with the majority of people who are already in Northern Ireland, who are already feeling they have no friendship. They have no friends in the Irish government, in the British government, and they're being marginalized in Northern Ireland.
Yeah, I think that's the big issue. And the other thing is they look across the water and there's every possibility that Scotland may vote within a few years to leave the United Kingdom. And where does that leave them? So they see themselves as surrounded on all sides by enemies. But what worked in 92, 93 was to approach them and say, look, we know you have issues. We know you have issues with unemployment. We know you have issues with drugs. We know you have issues with politics in the sense that you do the dirty work for the Democratic Unionist Party, and you get nothing in return. I think you have to try and understand their mentality, even though it can be very difficult at times because some of them are not the nicest people in the world. But they are part of the solution, and that is what you have to go in thinking, and that's the only way you can look at it. And, you know, you can condemn violence, and you and I know that for 30 years people were condemning violence every week in Northern Ireland. It made not a bit of difference until we went in and tackled the causes of the violence with President Clinton and people like Nancy Soderbergh and people like Tony Lake back then.
Yeah.
And we need to do the same thing now, is what are the causes of this violence? How do we try and find a way around it? And how do we try and secure a future that everybody in Northern Ireland can feel? That sounds fair to me.
Neil, as usual, by the way, to kind of put me in the role of Deborah's advocate, they're the voice of, the loyalists and unionists, and saying thanks very much for that. I thought at least you'd meet me halfway and take over. But
well, you know, Adrian, in the 36 years I've been talking to you, Mayo have not won the All-Ireland.
Yeah, okay. All right. Anya, will you cut this? Just cut him off. That's it. Got Kevin O'Connor over there waiting.
Just want to make sure you know that.
Louther, Kerry, where the hell are you from anyway? Because
I'm from the Aran Islands.
Yeah, well, if you are, you'd be doing, we give you more airtime. But, that was very nice to bring that up. Okay,
yeah.
That's good. But again, I just want you to touch on, and the only reason that I'm doing this now is Anya has to get in touch with Kevin O'Connor, so I will either have to play the Irish washerwoman or, So, now, just tell us how, if you look back on the pandemic, and how... a great section of elderly Irish Americans who have lost the dream of ever seeing Ireland again, or getting to the point where everybody is, or a lot of people are thinking in terms of, it's okay, ever changing rules, regulations, getting to Ireland. Back and forth, the confusion that that reigns there. How do you feel, as somebody who's deeply involved in media, how is that, it's too soon to talk about the after effects.
Yeah, I think, you know, it was so confusing for a while. Some people said you had to quarantine for 15 days in a hotel. Other people said you had to do it for 5 days or whatever. What I do know now is the clarity is there that on July 19th, they intend to basically get back to normal. And that happens to coincide with the day that I'm going to go over there, because last thing I wanted to do was spend 5 days of a 2-week vacation locked up in my house, in my brother's house. So I think that they've finally got their act together. I think the reality is that, like in America, mistakes were made, huge mistakes were made over opening up at Christmas, but we can all say things, you know, in reality, we were dealing with something very profound and dangerous that, in the end, you know, thankfully we found a solution, because I, at one point, didn't think I'd see Ireland again the way things were looking.
Yeah, most of us looked at that and say, you know, what's the flavor of the month, what's the flavor of the week here, with, and blame politicians, which at the end of the day, that's easy to, you know, to shove the blame. But anyway, it's going to be there. Media, Irish-American media, and of course you as co-founder of the magazine, Irish-American magazine, Irish Central, Irish Voice newspaper. How is that Irish-American media, how is that viewed through all of this? Was it a positive in the sense that many more people wanted to get out of general information and find something about Ireland, find out how you narrowed that down to how it affected Irish Americans and those who wanted, say, to go to Ireland. How did you find that, and those in was a very small group in Irish American media?
Well, I think, you know, the biggest damage that was done to us was advertising. We're a company that depends heavily on travel and entertainment and bar ownership and basically everything that was stopped, full stop, way back over 18 months ago now. So I think that was the biggest single problem that we had to deal with, which was our entire Aer Lingus Tourism Ireland, big clients that we would depend on every year, just simply disappeared for all the obvious reasons. So I haven't anything good to say about the media and the pandemic and what it did to the media. I think it was, you did get more readers certainly on the website and you got more interest. But I think the overall view was, you know, things were bad enough beforehand in terms of media, as you know, in terms of how things are happening in the American media generally. And the pandemic was the last thing we all needed. But, you know, you just got to put one foot in front of the other and keep going. I know you've done that for 50 years at least now. And I think that's what the lesson was, that you find a way to survive and hope that the good days are ahead.
On that note, you know, from your lips to God's ears, it's terrific, and it's it really is all, you know, all the slagging that we do aside, is to actually hear, you know, from you and get the significant points, because again, nothing is as scary for any of us as to think, well, you know, this will be forgotten when the summit is over and we'll be right back to square one. This is different, Neil. Thank you for spelling it out for us.
Absolutely, Adrian. Thanks again for the opportunity.
Okay. A million thanks. Okay. Neil O'Dowd, friends, who definitely knows how to dissect some of the most important issues, and definitely a major link in terms of information between Ireland and America. You're listening to The Flannelly Show live from New York City. And friends, do feel free to get in touch with us again. Best way, Aine, A-I-N-E, @irishradio.com. Okay.